If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, welcome again to Life on Planet Porky, the latest podcast here from myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, rock chick writer extraordinaire. Leslie Ann, as we're recording, welcome, and great to be conversing with you again. But you're actually on the brink of a bit of a dramatic development. And when I say dramatic, I mean dramatically good. In the passage of your book, to the market, the book on John Lennon, Who Killed John Lennon. Tell me all about it.
Well, thanks, Mike. We've just gone live with the big cover reveal, which is always a thrilling moment for an author. Because we tend to put out holding covers, you know, just a temporary, for now kind of cover. But then comes the moment of the big reveal. And we've gone live with that. So everybody can have a look and see what that looks like. There's a great little film on my Twitter that people can check out if they would like to, and also a little system for the pre-order of both the book and the audio book.
That's fantastic. You know a lot more about these things than me because you've written a lot of very successful books, but how important is it to have a picture of the book subject on the cover? I know that might sound mad, but lots of people experiment with covers and it doesn't always work.
It doesn't. I mean, it can sort of make or break a book, really. I think with a big biographical subject, you really need to have some sort of image of the subject on the cover because, you know, pictures speak louder than words, don't they? It's the instant contact that we make with a book when we look in a bookshop.
Definitely.
I mean, obviously fiction is different, but with a biographical subject, I think we do need to see their face.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've written one very successful book and a couple that, you know, are just sort of very average, to be honest. But the one that got into the Sunday Times bestseller list was There's an awful lot of bubbly in Brazil, okay? And we were commissioned by a publisher who basically only dealt in sports books. So we had greater ambitions than just to make it a story about a footballer, you know? So they came up with their first cover design and it was awful. It didn't even have a picture of Al on the front. You know, it was just bizarre. And I got together with Al's daughter, Michelle, lovely girl who's, you know, runs a very successful PR business. And I came up with the idea of calling the book There's an Awful Lot of Bubbly in Brazil, based on the old advert, you know, there's an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. And the reason being, Al drinks champagne most days. So then, of course, we had a picture of Al with bottles of bubbly, glasses of champagne, horses racing around in the background because there was a lot of, you know, stories from racetracks in it and all that. Very exciting cover, looked great. And it, you know, as I said, it became bestseller. It sold over 100,000 copies. Now, we then had the contract for the follow-up, and I didn't pay enough attention to the cover and the follow-up. And the follow-up was called Both Barrels from Brazil, because that was supposed to be Al giving his view on life like Jeremy Clarkson type style, you know what I mean? And they came up with a cover which I didn't pay enough attention to, and the barrels were the necks of two champagne bottles, okay, put together to look like a shotgun, you know, a sawn-off shotgun, and both barrels from Brazil. And there was no picture of Al, and the book flopped.
Yeah, completely understandable. Because you've got to see their face.
Yeah.
You know, it's that instant recognition thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it doesn't always have to be a photograph. It can be a sketch, you know, drawings, but some sort of image that makes that connection in the potential reader's mind before they even read the words on the cover.
No, I totally agree. Where can people get to see this cover if they want to, Leslie Ann?
Oh, on my Twitter, which is at LAJWriter. That little film is right there.
Yeah.
I'm so in love with it. I'm thrilled with what they've done.
That's great. Good. Well, I hope everybody takes a look at it. I actually haven't seen it as I speak because it's been released during the course of this studio session between you and I. But I look forward to seeing it very much indeed. Talking about books, by the way, Leslie, and this is a great story. The author became bestseller by buying his own books. An author has lost his top 10 position in the bestsellers charts after revealing he bought 400 copies. I didn't know you could get into the bestseller list by buying 400 copies. 400 copies of his own book to push himself up the rankings. Mark Dewson spent 3,600 quid on copies of his thriller, The Cleaner, from a children's bookshop in Salisbury after seeing it in 13th spot in the midweek sales chart. As a result, he rose up the rankings and entered the top 10 on the Sunday Times bestseller list at number 8. So, do you have people scouring the world, Leslie Ann, who are going to go diving in and out of bookshops to buy a copy of Who Killed John Lennon?
Well, I kind of wish that I did, you know, but I mean, look, no, it's underhand practice, isn't it? Obviously, it goes on. He can't be the first author ever to have done such a thing.
Yeah.
And you've only got to compare it to the music artists who've had record companies and managers behind them all these years doing precisely that with their singles.
Yeah.
You know, Brian Epstein used to do this with the early Beatles singles, believe it or not. He had a record shop as well, a music shop in Liverpool, and he would be buying the stock that he'd already bought in to sell in the shop. He was buying that himself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not the shocking scandal that, you know, we might at first think it is. But, and, of course, it's not fair on other authors who do things the legitimate way.
Yeah, but they've been, nevertheless, the books have been bought, haven't they? And then he could give them away to other people if he wanted. I mean, you know, I know it's a very sharp practice, but I didn't think it was worth banning him for it. But anyway, he did. The Sunday Times kicked him off the best-selling list.
Well, they've got to, haven't they? They've got to make a show of solidarity with other authors and fairness and fair play.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Has always got to be seen to be done, hasn't it?
I totally agree. Fair play is the name of the game. Am I right in thinking that Brian Epstein's shop wasn't actually a record shop? It was a furniture shop with a little counter in the corner where they sold records, wasn't it?
Not quite. No, his family had a massive furniture shop, sort of well-known and well-to-do kind of furniture shop.
Yeah, yeah.
If you were anybody in Liverpool, you had something that was bought in that shop.
Yeah.
But he had the shop next door, which sold musical instruments and sheet music, and then started to stock records as well.
Yeah, oh, that's very good. And as we're just talking about pop stars for the moment, I thought I'd just raise another story came to my attention since I last spoke to you about your old friend Brian May. Brian May's efforts to help the spread of bovine tuberculosis in cattle at dairy farms in Devon without harming badgers has suffered a crippling blow. May 73 announced in March that Gatcombe Farm near Seaton had become iconic because it had managed to eradicate the disease in cattle without killing any badgers. The farm had been free of bovine TB for a year. May sold more than 300 million albums with Queen, had paid more than 30,000 through his charity to vaccinate badgers in the area against tuberculosis. However, it has emerged that the disease has entered the Gatcombe dairy herd. So that's a bit of a blow for old Brian.
Well, it is, and you have to admire him. He's been astonishingly busy with his efforts to save the badger and to not bring back fox hunting.
That's
and, you know, he's very ecologically conscious, isn't he, Brian? And he loves animals, and he's doing his best. He's kind of a one-man campaign.
Yeah.
Of course, he's not doing a lot right now because he's had a heart attack recently. And we must make, you know, sort of send him our best wishes for a speedy recovery. And may he be back on the case very soon.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Now, I don't know whether you've made yourself a cup of tea before we got into the recording studio this morning, Leslie Ann, but I wonder...
Yeah, got one right here.
Have you got one right there? That's great. Okay. And tell me this, of course, because you are a lady who's very aware of the world around you and you want to save the world and all that kind of stuff. It's very commendable. Have you got oat milk in your tea? Because this is the latest fad.
I have absolutely got oat milk in my tea.
I was joking.
I know you were, but I'm not. And I do have oat milk in my tea. And my family drink nothing else but oat and almond milk. Those are our two favourites.
Really?
Yep.
Where do you get this oat and almond milk from? I mean, you know, when I go to the supermarket, I see rows of green top milk, rows of blue top milk, rows of red top milk. I never see the old oat milk. You must go to specialist shops.
No, not at all. If you go around the corner to these sort of end of the aisle bits in Sainsbury's or Tesco, Waitrose, anywhere you shop, they all have now these banks of fridges with all the various non-dairy milks available.
Oh, really? Well, you know, maybe I'll try. I just think that the best milk you can get is the milk out of a cow, to be honest, because that's what nature intended.
No. Whoever decreed it was natural for humans to drink cow's milk? Well, whose idea was that in the first place?
Cows were put on Earth to provide steak and beef, and to provide the bacon butties in the morning and sausages, okay?
So, oh, come on. Cow's milk is meant for baby cows, you know? Whoever thought that this was a good idea to feed to human children? I have no idea. But have you ever been to a dairy farm?
As a kid, I went to a school in sort of on the outskirts of Chester, and a lot of the kids there were farmers' children. And when they had a birthday party, it was always so exciting because when you're 8 or 9, given an afternoon to mess around on a farm, you know, climbing in the hay bales and all that kind of stuff. And the thing that always used to fascinate me were the, you know, the sheds where they milked the cows with all those machines. So, yes, the answer is I have been to a couple of dairy farms, but not for about 4 decades or 5.
Well, they're pretty disgusting places and they stink. And I feel that the sight...
Well,
the sight of those hairy pink udders, you know, is enough to put anybody off for life. I do not want to drink cow's milk. People are welcome to drink it if they want to. But for me, for my family, you know, we're all sort of in it together. My kids are adults, but they don't want to drink cow's milk either.
Well, what did you put in your tea then when you were whizzing around the world as a rock chick writer? You know, I don't think they've got too much oat milk tea in Baghdad, for instance, have they?
Well, I wasn't into tea in those days. I was with Alan Brazil. I was on the champagne.
Right, yeah, okay. Well, that's a much better idea. Talking about Baghdad, by the way, because we talked about that in our last podcast, and you told me about a very exciting trip you went on there with, who was it? With
Annie Nightingale and Adrian Boot and the rock band, Hurrah.
That's right, okay, yeah. Now, although Baghdad, of course, is the capital of a really sort of dictatorial state, it actually works, doesn't it? It worked in those days when somebody was in charge. Even though it was Saddam Hussein, it worked. And my view has always been that in the West, if you try and force democracy on people in Middle East countries, you're on a loser from the start. It's impudent, it's arrogant, and we shouldn't get involved in other people's affairs because a lot of those Middle East countries, they work along tribal lines rather than geographical lines, and strong men rise to the top and they rule. Now, of course, there's been two wars with Iraq. The first one, George Bush Sr. just said, get out of Kuwait. And when they did, he let them be. Second, George Bush decided he was going to insist on regime change. I saw a documentary this week on what happened to Iraq in the aftermath of that invasion. It is utterly, shockingly horrifying how the invasion forces, the Americans and ours led by Tony Blair, literally abandoned a country to its fate to, you know, to let 3 or 4 civil wars break out. And it broke my heart to see a nation smashed up like that.
Well, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that it was all the way back in 2003 when this US-led invasion took place. Mm. And that incredible city, Baghdad, was virtually destroyed. And the war and the collateral damage has continued for years. The United Nations did mount a campaign, a fund for reconstruction from about 2004 to 2007. And they say that the city is quite at peace and safe to visit now, but I'm not sure I want to go there because there is a very high threat of terrorist attack and also kidnappings, very complicated politics. Anything can break out at any moment.
Absolutely.
And you're right, they destroyed a city, they destroyed a country. Yeah. And where did they go after that? You know, are we holding Tony Blair to account?
Well, yeah, after that, they went to Libya. That was David Cameron, a Tory prime minister, decided to smash up Libya as well. Exactly the same prognosis, you know, strong Middle East country, OK, run by a fairly unpleasant dictator, but that's the way you have to do things in the Middle East. Oh, I tell you what, we'll do the population a favour and get rid of him. And then you've got anarchy and civil war. But the two things that most struck me about this documentary on Iraq, after they invaded and took over, First of all, George W. Bush thought that anybody associated with Saddam should be sacked from government. He didn't realise that most of the government's made up of Saddam supporters, the Baathists, right? So the whole government was sacked, not just the government, the civil service, everybody. Then he decided that you couldn't trust the Iraqi military, so he decommissioned all of them, 400,000 soldiers, who, of course, then became mercenaries running around the country with any stolen weapons they could find. It was utter chaos and almost, you know, George W. Bush should be held to account historically for destroying a great country.
Very much so. But I mean, their economy was shot to pieces to start with. I can remember going into a cafe and paying 40 quid, the equivalent of, for a cup of tea.
When was that? When you went there?
Yeah.
What year did you go there?
Oh, I must have been late 90s, thinking back.
I was in Libya in about the same. No, I was in Libya in middle 80s, late 80s or something like that. And everything just worked. I mean, nobody spoke up against the government, but nobody dared step out of line. You know what I mean? It was kind of very efficient in a way. But anyway, there you go. That's getting too serious, I'm afraid. So let's get a little less serious and tell me if you've ever had any dealings or adventures with a man with the greatest name in rock music, Slash.
Slash. Well, yeah, I did have cause to interview Slash, actually. Mm-hmm. He's the lead guitarist of Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Because his mother, Ola Hudson, had an affair with David Bowie back in the day. And Slash actually remembered Bowie rocking up at their house and he and his mom sort of sneaking off upstairs quite brazenly, I hasten to add. And it kind of caused Slash a few problems growing up, I think.
Well, it would cause you a few problems. You're sitting there with your mum, David Bowie rocks up on the doorstep, one of the world's most famous rock stars, and takes your mother upstairs to give her a bit of horizontal refreshment. I mean, well, how old was Slash when this happened?
He was a kid. I mean, it's not very good, is it really? But rock and roll, guys.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I say a bit too far. I tell you the only thing I remember about him, we were in an editorial conference one morning and the features editor, was saying, about this great group Guns N' Roses, and there was he a bass player or something, Slash?
So lead guitarist.
Lead guitarist, okay. And he said, and the problem is that the lead guitarist of this group, Guns N' Roses, who nobody had ever really heard about till then, demands that the pop world take him more seriously, that the music world take him more seriously. He is a gifted and serious musician. And Nick Lloyd, Sir Nick Lloyd, our editor, said, "What's his name?" And the features editor, Slash. The room erupted,
Yeah, let's all take him seriously with a name like that.
That's right. Yeah, good old Slash. He's a genius, obviously.
But don't you think he got his look from Mark Bolan and T-Rex because he wears that sort of leather top hat with all the cascading ringlets underneath and so on? I always thought that he nicked his look from Mark.
Well, maybe. I don't remember too much about him, to be honest. But why did they call themselves Guns N' Roses when that name is so synonymous with the Rolling Stones?
Is it?
Well, yeah, to me it is. Guns N' Roses, Rolling Stones, they're kind of triple.
I can't really hear that one, Mike. No, talk me through that one.
Well, listen, where do they come from? Are they Scottish?
Los Angeles.
I thought they were Scottish. Because the lead singer was a guy called Axel somebody, wasn't he?
Axel Rose, yeah.
Yeah, Axel Rose. That's where the Roses bit came, didn't it?
Well, maybe. They only came on the scene in about 1985.
Right.
But do you remember the singles? Welcome to the Jungle, Paradise City,
Probably.
Sweet Child of Mine. I mean, fantastic. Fantastic hard rock.
Yeah.
And sort of a really driven sound. Cool. You must remember the cover they did of Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah, I do.
So I don't usually like covers of McCartney or Beatles songs, but that, to me, is almost as perfect as the original.
Yeah, no, I have to admit, I do remember that, and I thought it was quite powerful because, obviously, anything written by the Beatles is always high in my firmament. Now, look, young B's got married, right? Young lady gets married in a beautiful church with an archway of roses above the entrance and all that kind of stuff. Looks very happy and all that. But what a shocking indictment of the way that Prince Andrew has been disgraced, in the eyes of the establishment and the British people, that he couldn't even appear in a picture of his daughter's wedding.
Well, was it that he wasn't allowed to, or did he simply choose not to be?
One or the
because,
other, still bad.
You know, the pictures I saw, Fergie, the mother, wasn't in the pictures either, was she? Or the pictures that they chose to release to the public, how do we know that there were not private pictures for the family album that's got the whole lot of them in?
I'm sure there are. And that's obviously something they did after the public pictures and all that kind of stuff. But the fact that Prince Andrew is too ashamed, or the establishment is too ashamed, to allow him to appear in a picture of his daughter on her wedding day is a shocking, shocking indictment of what's going on. And I mean, every day we learn something new about Ghislaine Maxwell, which, you know, makes us all shudder at the enormity of what could have gone on. I started watching, by the way, even though I thought I'd probably read most of it in newspapers, I started watching Dirty Money, which is the Epstein documentary on Netflix. And it's even worse than I could have imagined, the way that, according to this program, allegedly, Ghislaine's job was recruiting up to 3 young girls a day to get them immersed, allegedly, in the Epstein, you know, seediness and the world he lived in. I think it's going to be a horrible story that spills out when this eventually gets to trial.
Pretty disgusting. But even worse, the Mail on Sunday carried a big feature last weekend. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, go on.
About where Epstein may have got his millions from.
Unbelievable.
And the very strong suggestion is that it came from Robert Maxwell's stolen Mirror pension fund.
Your father's money.
Exactly. And that Ghislaine started his fortune for him.
Yeah.
So that if that's true, that would explain an awful lot.
Well, that story was so interesting, the one you're talking about, because It suggested, and investigations have sort of backed this up, that what he was very good at was taking hundreds of millions of pounds from very wealthy people who'd made the money in a dubious way and then hiding it where the authorities couldn't find it. It was said that he'd done that for people in the Middle East, for Middle East countries, for bent businessmen. And yes, Robert Maxwell's named amongst it. So the picture we've got now is that Robert Maxwell pilfered £400 million from the Mirror pension fund, including your father's lifetime pension, gave it to Epstein. The connection then with Ghislaine was because obviously she was Maxwell's daughter, and that was the start of their evil deeds. It's almost incomprehensible, isn't it?
Well, it's so terrible and so evil that it's almost unbelievable. If you were a sort of thriller novelist, you couldn't have come up with a plot to match this, could you?
No, you couldn't. And by the way, I thought it was amazing that President Trump, once again, you know, with complete unawareness or complete, I don't know, idiocy, said in a public statement, you know, well, Ghislaine used to live with her down in Palm Beach. You know, she lived there, I lived there, and I wish her well.
I wish her well. What is that about? Why is the President of the United States wishing a felon well? She's in prison at least until next July, so she's incarcerated for a year, and he is wishing her well?
Yeah, I know.
And nobody seems to think there's anything wrong with that.
No, I know. It's a wacky world of Trump. It'll be very interesting to see what happens in the election this year in November, because he was as far behind Hillary Clinton 4 years ago as he is now behind Joe Biden. But he came through and won. And nobody knows really what's going to happen.
And I think Kanye West is now off the case, isn't he?
Well, that is another sort of idiocy that nobody can work out. At the start, everybody suggested that Trump had, you know, leaned on Kanye West, the Trump-supporting pop star, one of the few in the world, to make him stand to see if he could split the vote, the black vote. Now it transpires that this Kanye West self-nomination to be president might be part of a very disturbing mental illness.
Well, what I'm also wondering is if he hasn't come up with the mental illness. I hope this doesn't offend anybody who's genuinely suffering from mental illness.
Yeah.
But maybe this is all a ruse to let him off the hook because he realised what an idiotic thing to say he was going to run for president when he clearly hasn't got the nous to do it or the experience or the political knowledge.
No.
So maybe this is his get-out clause.
Mm, maybe. It's not a good time, is it, for the revelation of the private lives of the rich and the famous, because the case involving Johnny Depp and Amber Heard just goes on from day to day and it gets worse. Look, I'm not prejudging anything in this case, but you kind of feel they sort of deserve each other a bit, don't you?
Oh, we've said it before. It really reminds me of that film, The War of the Roses. Yes, you know, said, yeah. Whatever he's slinging at her, she's slinging at him.
Yeah.
They've been divorced for a few years now. Mm. What difference does it make? Why did all of this have to be dragged out?
Yeah.
It's so unedifying and disgusting, yeah. most of it.
Because,
and yeah. it doesn't, you know, they've got fans all waiting outside the courtroom, uh-huh. people giving them flowers, blowing them kisses, all of this. So these yeah. people are still considered iconic.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're still worshipped mm. by the fans. Mm. And people are not going to be able to see that actually this behaviour is the lowest of the low.
That's right. There's a guy there walking around every day. We love you, Johnny Depp. You know,
I know.
Not even a star-struck woman, you know.
I'm hiding behind the sofa watching this stuff on TV unfold. It's yeah. disgraceful.
Yeah.
And these are not good examples of how to conduct a marriage or a divorce, come to that.
No, I agree. I'm actually quite impressed with their demeanours as they go in and out of court. They don't look as though they feel any shame or embarrassment about this horrendous catalogue of behaviour that's spilling out. They're all standing there, waving to fans, smiling, pictures, sure, you know, it's just remarkable. I think what you said earlier is right. They live in such a world of their own. They don't really care about public opinion, do they?
Well, it's shameless. It's a publicity opportunity, isn't
yeah.
it? Photo opportunity.
Yeah.
So it's all about the coverage in the papers.
Mm.
I can't believe this when I look at it. It's all about what they're wearing, the latest outfit, what colour scarf she's got
yeah.
tied around her face to, you know, protect her from coronavirus yeah. and all of this. Hang on a minute, guys. We've got the disintegration of a relationship
yeah.
to the most astonishing, apparently violent degree.
Mm.
And people are writing about what colour clothes she's wearing.
What hairstyle she's got each day. You know, apparently she's got a hairstyle now like somebody in one of those Avatar films or whatever they're called, you know.
Oh, well, no, it was Frozen.
Yeah,
she's got
yeah,
the hairstyle
yeah,
like the chick in Frozen whose name I don't know.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah.
But, I mean, really,
yeah.
just the sooner this is over and we can get back to normal, the better as yeah. far as I'm concerned.
Totally agree.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Leslie Ann here in fine form, getting a bit feisty about a subject or two, but that's what Leslie Ann's all about. Leslie Ann, do you ever get backache? And have you had backache problems over the time of self-isolation and lockdown?
Because absolutely not.
No, well, I read a report, medical report. I keep my eye on the medical papers, by the way, because I'm still waiting for the massive breakthrough in heart treatment, which will guarantee me another 20 years of life instead of a possible 20 weeks or 20 months. You see what I mean? So I keep an eye on the developments there, and I've already contacted my doctors about some miracle cures that I've read about, but unfortunately none of them stand up scientifically. But have you ever had backache?
No, because it's all about posture. And my mother taught us when we were children,
yeah.
all four of us,
yeah.
how to sit at the table. We were never allowed to slump
yeah.
over our food. We had to sit with our back straight and our shoulders back, no elbows on the table,
yeah.
all of that kind of thing. And it was quite sort of drummed into us in a military way, you
yeah.
know?
No, I agree.
So perfect posture has always been a thing of mine. I spend many hours a day sitting, writing at a screen.
You do.
And
you
if I were allowed to slump, yeah. if I allowed myself to slump,
yeah.
I would, especially at my age, I would soon develop a backache.
Yeah.
And that's something, once you have it,
yeah.
it's incredibly hard to get rid of.
Oh, incredibly hard. My poor sister, younger than me, she's a year younger, she goes to Pilates and yoga 3 or 4 times a week. And if she doesn't, she gets backache. You know what I mean? She just has to, just to keep her in trim. I get attacks of sciatica about 3 times a year.
And that is such a great word. It's so Welsh. Sciatica.
Sciatica, boyo. But, you know, nobody can work it out. I've been to see physios and everybody, and they just say, look, once it kicks in, I'm afraid you can't get rid of it. And they're right. It lasts about 10 days, and then it just goes of its own accord. But it is absolutely agonising. You can't get out of bed in the morning. You can't walk more than about 20 or 30 yards. It sends sharp, stabbing pains from the bottom of your back through your buttocks down your thighs into your feet, you know, and it's something I've never been able to get rid of. You know, you wear copper bracelets and all that kind of stuff.
But some people would pay good money for that.
Yes, I suppose they would, yeah. probably with a machine that's got an electrical impulse or something like
that. Yeah, we won't go there.
We won't go there. We won't go there. Now then, did you ever have any dealings with Yusuf Islam?
Oh, yeah. I went to interview him up in North London once he'd become Yusuf Islam.
Did you know him before?
I put my hand out to shake his hand, and he sort of stepped right back and withdrew as if to say, don't touch me, you woman.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't, do they? They don't touch females. But yeah, he was obviously Cat Stevens in the good old days.
Yeah.
He was actually Steve Georgiou, or Steve the Greek. That's how he was known in the music industry. Steve the Greek. But I was a massive fan of Cat Stevens' music when I was quite young, actually. So I had all the albums, Matthew and Son, Tea for the Tillerman, Tease of the Firecat.
Yeah.
Catch Bullet 4 was my favourite.
Right.
Big, big album in 1972.
Yeah.
But you remember the singles, Moon Shadow, Morning Has Broken, Father and Son. I mean, what an artist. What a very gentle soul and fabulous songwriter, wasn't he?
Well, the one I most remember was My Lady d'Auburnville. Because I was only a kid and I couldn't work out why this pop star had written a song about a lady lying in a grave. It quite worried me. No, My Lady d'Auburnville, why do you lie so still? I'll wake you tomorrow and you will be my fill. My Lady d'Auburnville.
You are so wasted. You are so wasted, Michael.
No, what I found most interesting is that if I've got it right, and you will know better, he led the rock star life. He was shagging around all the time. He would try and impress girlfriends by hiring private planes and flying them to Greece for a special cup of coffee and all this kind of stuff. You know, big shagger, who then completely changed his lifestyle to one, what I think, and I'm not insulting anybody in their religion, but one of the most staid and, to my mind, boring life sets you can possibly have as a religious imam.
Well, do you know what happened? Do you know why that happened?
Well, I read a report once in which he said, I just woke up one morning and said, I can't go around having sex with all my friends' wives anymore. I've got to change my life.
It wasn't quite like that.
Right.
He had a near drowning experience in Malibu.
Right.
Off the beach in Malibu. And
he's full of toxic substances.
No, he was just out swimming and he nearly drowned. And he had the most profound sort of life examination experience. And he spoke to his brother about it. His brother sent him a copy of the Quran.
Yeah.
And he read it. He was experimenting with different religions, trying to find out, you know, how could he get close to God? What was God? Who is God? Mm. What is this? And the Quran was the text that made the most sense to him.
Yeah.
And so he converted to Islam.
Yeah.
And continued on with music, making sort of Islamic music from then on. But he's back sort of in the pop world now, rock and pop, back singing, recording, touring. His 2017 album, I think, is the most recent. I might be wrong about that, but it's called The Laughing Apple, and it's gorgeous. And he's dropped the Islam from his name. He's just Yusuf these days.
But is he still a practicing sort of preacher running a faith school for children?
Not so much of that now. No, he's back in the recording world.
Okay, well, I'm glad because he was a great talent and it's, you know... It's,
still is. Great, great artist.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. To have hidden away for all that time with that talent. You see, if there is a God, my view is, and I believe in God and you do, but I mean, talking about everybody's different interpretation of God, didn't he then have a duty to use the talent that whichever God he believes in had given him to then go around entertaining other people instead of not doing it?
You could see it that way, or you could say, well, he had to step away from the lifestyle he'd become immersed in and had constructed for himself. Mm. He had to pause, he had to stop, reinvent himself, give back for a period of time, which he did.
Yeah, no.
And he's come full circle now, and I guess the whole thing is in balance these days.
Yeah, maybe. You may be absolutely right. Now, when was the last time you went into your bank?
Oh, like years ago. I can't remember. In fact, my bank shut down because I remember my branch actually is the one, the NatWest opposite BBC, the BBC headquarters, you know,
Broadcasting
House, right at the top of Regent Street there. Been my bank for 35 years.
Yeah.
And I think I went to go there last year because I just happened to be up there.
Mm.
And I had a couple of checks, you know, who sends checks anymore?
Yeah.
But I think my mum may have given me a check or something.
Mm.
And I thought, I'll just nip into my bank and pay it in. And the bank wasn't even there anymore. It had closed down.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I established a bank account in Redditch, in Worcestershire, when I worked for the Birmingham Evening Mail in the Redditch District Office. I thought I might as well transfer my account here. And I've been with Barclays like over 50 years now, because I had a bank account when I was about 14. And that bank no longer exists. That's all been transferred to Central and all that kind of stuff. I haven't actually been in a bank for about 30 years, I don't think. And the reason I'm talking about this is because Newquay, which is a lovely town down in Cornwall, isn't it? Not Devon, yeah, Cornwall, Newquay, yeah. And they've actually got a street there called Bank Street, because they used to have so many banks, they renamed the street Bank Street so people would know where to go to find a bank. And there were one time there were 9 banks there, and there's not a single bank. The last bank has closed. Now, there's a big outcry about this, that it will leave old people stranded and all that kind of stuff, but it shouldn't, should it?
No, I mean, my mother was talking to her the other day. She said, can you come over? Because I would like to go to the bank.
Yeah.
So what do you need in the bank, Mom? Well, I need to go and get some money out to give to the grandchildren. Well, you can do that online.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I don't want to do online. I don't do online, she says. And she is 85. She's typical of her generation
in that she
doesn't use the internet.
Yeah.
She's never wanted to. I've offered to set her up with it and teach her many times. She's not interested.
Yeah.
You know, she knows enough as far as she's concerned. I've got enough things in my head, she says.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do that. And I think that many, many old people, I know there are silver surfers who do genealogy online and all that great stuff, but not all old people want to do it. And so I do think some form of banking needs to continue to serve those people who have banked with those banks all their lives.
It's so expensive, you see, to have a big building in a high street, isn't it?
It is.
When you can just go to a call centre. But I totally agree. My mum, God rest her soul, was 25 as well when she sadly passed away a couple of years ago. But Mum believed, and I believe in a bit of this. I bank online because everybody does these days, you know. But interestingly, I don't. Well, when I say interestingly, the bank, I think they're very good at checking your account, and that I sometimes get these messages saying unusual activity and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get those.
Yeah, exactly. If you go out the country and something like that, they want to know where you are and all that. And I think that's very good. However, my greatest fear is having my fortune stolen off me. And so I don't keep residual money, that's money I'm not using, in the banks. I have a series of Building Society accounts where I keep it, and I'm not online with those. You see what I mean? So the only way I can get it is by actually going in. So I've been into Building Societies a couple of times a year over the years just to sort of check things out. And that makes me feel safer. I do still fear being robbed online.
But if society collapses, you know, which it could do if the whole coronavirus thing explodes, we haven't seen anything yet.
Mm.
And if society disintegrates,
yeah,
what happens to your money in the building societies?
Well, what happens to the network banking system online? It probably would collapse along with everything else. And then you wouldn't be able to access your money, you know.
That's right. So people are stuffing their money under their mattresses again. You know, we're getting back to that, aren't we?
Well, you might as well, because there's no interest on anything these days. 0.1% is a usual sort of return now on money in a bank. And you might as well stuff it under. I mean, that's the next great fear, really, raging inflation, isn't it? If you have to pump so much money back into the economy, then, you know, your money just disappears overnight. Anyway, look, it's not worth thinking about. This Life on Planet Porky is to uplift people, not to upset people. Talking about uplifting people, Daniel Radcliffe is 31 years of age this week. My God, in such a short lifetime, he's had so much success, hasn't he, that boy?
It's hard to imagine him as an adult, really, because of all those years of following the Harry Potter saga. You know, my kids were so into the Harry Potter books and the films. They grew up to all that. Their whole childhood was set against that sort of fictional series, if you like. That I still see Daniel Radcliffe as a little boy.
Yeah, with the round glasses on, with the what we used to call the Milky Bar Kid glasses. That's right, yeah.
Yeah. But, anyway, happy birthday to him.
Yes. Has he broken away from Harry Potter sufficiently? Because I've seen him, I haven't seen him, but I've seen reviews of him in stage plays and all that kind of stuff. But to anybody who is so identified with such an iconic role, can they ever break away?
I think they have to. I mean, yeah. It's a bit like being Rami Malek, isn't it? And having portrayed Freddie Mercury. Will he forever be known as Freddie Mercury, or does he have the right to go ahead and portray other people? Yeah. I have to say, I've experienced at a very minor level a certain amount of this, because you get the fans of, say, an artist that you've written a book about, and they seem to believe that you can only have written about that particular artist, almost to the point that you're not allowed to go ahead and write about anybody else, which of course is ludicrous. If you're a writer, you can write about umpteen subjects, any number of artists, of course, if that's the discipline that you're in. But it is strange how odd people can be about that. But you know, you've broken your allegiance to somebody if you go ahead and do a film or write a book about somebody else.
Well, I can't watch Daniel Craig in anything except a Bond film now. I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I didn't see Layer Cake, which I thought was a very good film, starring Daniel Craig. I didn't see that until after his first James Bond film, and it was completely unreal to me. I thought, what's James Bond doing in Layer Cake? But if he quits now, as I think he has done, I think he's made his last film, what's he going to do now for the rest of his life?
Well, he's always going to be a Bond, but the same as Sean Connery or Roger Moore are always going to be.
I don't think anybody who's come out of the Bond, you know, sequence of films has gone on to be anything like the person they were before Bond.
Well, that's why they get paid so much money, because
is that right? That's true,
yes, their identity has been hijacked and they really are indelibly linked. So it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah.
You will always be Bond. You may have got 40 million for that picture and you can live on that for a couple of years. But really, you will never be able to portray anybody else without it being compared to Bond.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, though. I totally agree with that. Some people just can't. You know, if J.R. Ewing, Larry Hagman, had done anything except Dallas after Dallas. Funny enough, I saw him in a film recently before Dallas, and it was The Eagle Has Landed. Do you remember the book made into a film?
About, yeah, I do.
Michael Caine was in it and all that. And I thought he was very good in that. So I don't begrudge him having gone on to be one of the great all-time TV villains. Now, have you ever been to Todd Morden, Leslie Ann? Todd Morden's a little town in West Yorkshire.
I don't think I've been there, but I've been reading about it in the news lately.
Amazing. People seeing calves being lifted up in the air by aliens and then dropped from great heights. Cows, I'm talking about. Calves.
So back in 2016, the Daily Star first reported that aliens were massacring thousands of cows and harvesting their organs to make human-alien hybrids.
Really?
Now, here we are again. Is it silly season already?
Yeah, it sounds like a Daily Star story, that to me. I don't know why we take this seriously anymore. You can't possibly justify, you know, people being stolen. But actually, it wasn't that I was going to talk to you about Todd Morden. I saw it someone of Todd Morden. I did an amazing story in Todd Morden once. I was working for the Daily Express in Manchester, okay, and a report came through from Ulster of another attack on what they called a pig. A pig is an armoured car, you know, an army armoured car. And the IRA fired a missile at it, which was a particularly lethal missile. It went straight through the side of the armoured car. And as it did, it ignites a spinning warhead, which spews out red hot molten lead inside the vehicle, which attacks the men inside the vehicle. You see what I mean?
God, that's awful.
Yes, absolutely terrible. It was they believe it was a Russian device. But anyway, the point of the story is one of the men inside lost his legs from the molten lead that poured onto him from this missile. And we got the address of this lad, and he was from Todd Morden. So it was very far away, actually, Manchester, because Todd Morden's just on the border from Lancashire to Yorkshire. So, you know, and it's a very combative business we work in. So I jumped in my car, shot over there, and it was a remote place. They were a farming family, and found it and all that. And as I walked in through the door, I realised what a brilliant story this was going to be, because on the piano was a picture of this boy with a title above it. He was actually an army skiing champion.
Oh, God. And he'd lost his legs.
Oh,
dear God.
And, you know,
poor guy.
The minute I saw that, I mean, I know this is self-interest and obviously I had a lot of sympathy for the family. You know, can you imagine any soldier losing his legs is bad enough. But when you're actually the army skiing champion, which he was, and I, you know, I had to then adjust the way I spoke to his parents in a totally different form, you know what I mean, because of what he'd lost. And there's that crucial moment, Leslie Ann, which you will have suffered yourself at every moment. You talk to the family, you tried to be so sympathetic, the family were warming up to me and all that kind of stuff. Then came the moment when I had to say, I want to borrow that picture, please, of your son, the one on the piano. And you never know how they're going to react. Sometimes I had families say, what? How dare you? You're not going to use this, you know, to show the world what our boy was and what he is now and all that kind of stuff. But I kind of thought about it, chose the right moment and said, look, in tribute to your son, the world need to know what a great soldier he was, what a great server he was to his country, not just in the field, but for what he's achieved in skiing. Could I borrow that picture? And they happily gave it to me in the frame. And I took it back to Manchester. Because in those days, you couldn't do anything else. You know what I mean? You couldn't take a picture of it with your mobile phone or anything.
Nowadays, they do pickups. I mean, yes, you can do it with a mobile, but the old, you know, photographer would come down and do a pickup, wouldn't he? But I always used to say to these people, never part with your family photos because you won't get them back.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point. Now, I got there so quick that a photographer hadn't caught up with me. And I thought, well, I can't wait for a photographer because, you know as well as I do, 10 minutes down the road, the guy from the Daily Mail could be heading towards that farm. You see what I mean?
Oh, he's in the coal bunker waiting outside, ready to pounce.
And he might have a photographer with him. So, and the other thing, of course, is if I got that picture and took it, then nobody else could get it. You know what I mean? That was another thought in my mind.
Good thinking, Batman.
Exactly. But anyway, I got back in my car. I drove back. And again, you're not in constant communication with the officer because you haven't got a mobile phone. But the first safe phone box I found, I rang them and I said, this is a front page picture. And they said, why? I said, this guy's an army skiing champion. Oh, have you got the picture? I said, yeah, of course I've got it, you know. But then what I did is 2 days later, when the picture had been published and we'd used it and it was too late then for anybody else to have it, I drove back to the farm after work on the Thursday and I gave them the picture back. And
oh, good man. I'm glad you did that.
Exactly. I was never going to leave that, you know, with the dark room and say, this picture's got to go back to the family. You know what I mean? It's clearly such a valuable picture to remember their boy by. If that had gone missing, I'd never have forgiven myself. And you're quite right. A lot of those pictures did go missing, surely through neglect, you know?
Yeah. And I feel guilty about that, you know, because we sometimes do our job in good faith and you prize something out of somebody that was really precious. Yes, of course, I'll take care of it. I had exactly this situation happen when I was writing my first Freddie Mercury book. Okay. The very first girlfriend of Freddie, he'd been at school with her in India.
Yeah.
She was now living in Frankfurt. I managed to track her down. Mm. She posted me some pictures from her personal photo album from when they were 15 years old. And my publisher had put all the photos from the book that were obviously scanned and ready to go into the book.
Yeah.
He put all the originals in an envelope down beside his desk and left them there overnight. The cleaner had come round, thought this was rubbish, and threw them in the bin. And these were irreplaceable pictures. Obviously, we were able to give copies because they were scanned already.
Yeah.
But this poor woman who trusted me, you know, so I was... I didn't leave them on the floor. I wasn't the cleaner who threw them away, but that has haunted me. And so bizarrely, only yesterday, I got an email out of the blue from this same woman who now lives in Mumbai. And she's, well, it's 24 years later, and she managed to track me down. And she wanted to let me know that her son had died. Her son came to the launch party of that book.
Right.
And he was a very lovely man. But isn't it bizarre how what goes around comes around? Because she'd been in my mind, I'm going to write a new book about Freddie quite soon, and I wanted to contact her.
Right.
And fate has brought us together. It is really odd how those things happen.
It is. I totally agree. But you're absolutely right. The responsibility of taking something out of somebody's house and then not getting it back. Of course, the famous line we used to use in those days, people don't believe me when I tell them this. They'd say, well, how'd you get into a house if people wouldn't let you in? And I said, oh, you literally had to kick the door down and say you could smell gas. and you were trying to rescue them from the house blowing up.
I never went that far.
I'll tell you one time, I had to go and see John Conte. And I've worked with John Conte since over the years. And I've told him the story, funny story. And you know, Conte's career had come to an end. He's had a few problems, you know, marriage and all that kind of stuff. But really nice guy, John. And he lived in Bushey in Hertfordshire, and he had a detached house. And I rang, I was working then as a casual on a Sunday paper on a Saturday. You see what I mean? You know, one day a week on a Saturday. And the news editor, who was a Fleet Street legend as a nutcase, his name was PJ Wilson, right? A complete madman, Sunday Mirror. And I said, yeah, I can see the house from where I'm talking to you in the phone box. He said, right, have they got chimney? I said, yes, I've got chimney, yeah. He said, right, go next door, borrow a ladder and put a bag of cement over their chimney. We're going to smoke them out.
Oh, my God. There are lengths to which I will not go,
exactly,
you know?
Exactly. Anyway, needless to say, I didn't do it because I had to ring PJ back and say I couldn't find a bag of cement. You know?
Also, I could have got arrested for that.
Yeah,
but,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
But the sort of lengths that people went to. Right, OK. Well, Leslie-Anne, as always, a great pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you very much indeed.
Wonderful.
Best of luck, of course, with the revelation of the cover of your book, Who Killed John Lennon? And when people want to get a hold of you, where will they get a hold of you again?
Back on Twitter at LAJWriter.
Lovely. And I'm Mike Parry8 or planetporkypod@gmail.com. Leslie-Anne, until we meet again, take care, my dear.
Ciao for now. I did have cause to interview Slash, actually. He's the lead guitarist of Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Because his mother, Ola Hudson, had an affair with David Bowie back in the day. And Slash actually remembered Bowie rocking up at their house and he and his mom sort of sneaking off upstairs, quite brazenly, I hasten to add. And it kind of caused Slash a few problems growing up, I think.
Well, it would cause you a few problems. You're sitting there with your mum, David Bowie rocks up on the doorstep, one of the world's most famous rock stars, and takes your mother upstairs to give her a bit of horizontal refreshment. But how old was Slash when this happened?
He was a kid. I mean, it's not very good, is it really? Rock and roll, guys.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I say it a bit too far. He lived in Bushey in Hertfordshire, and he had a detached house. And I rang, I was working then as a casual on a Sunday paper on a Saturday, you see what I mean? You know, one day a week on a Saturday. And the news editor, who was a Fleet Street legend as a nutcase, his name was PJ Wilson, right? A complete madman, Sunday Mirror. And I said, yeah, I can see the house from where I'm talking to in the phone box. He said, right, have they got chimney? I said, yes, got chimney, yeah. He said, right, go next door, borrow a ladder and put a bag of cement over their chimney. We're going to smoke them out. My lady
You are so wasted, Michael.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.